The Society of Economic Geologists is thrilled to be hosting the SEG 2024 conference from the 27th to the 30th of September in Windhoek, Namibia, a country known for its spectacular geology and unique ore deposits. You can find out more at segweb.org/SEG-2024 for all the conference themes, dates, workshops, field trips, and more. Abstracts are now open until the 22nd of April. So come join us in Windhoek for what promises to be a geologic adventure in a country that is leading the way in mineral resource sustainability on the African continent. See you there.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Discovery to Recovery, where we bring you geoscience stories from the world of ore deposits. This podcast is a partnership between the Society of Economic Geologists and Goldspot Discoveries. You can listen on Spotify, iTunes, Google Podcasts, and more. My name is Aisha Ahmed, Senior Geochemist at Tech Resources, and I'm your host for this week's episode. Exploration geologists are known for being eternal optimists. Collecting one more sample, drilling one more hole is sure to find the next big one. Resource geologists, on the other hand, are faced with a different reality, one driven by numbers and statistics. How can better knowledge of the resource estimation process guide geologists in exploring for giant ore bodies? And how can the conceptual work of the exploration geologist feed into robust geological models? On today's episode, we try to bridge the divide between the first drill hole into a deposit and the resulting mineral reserve. Our first guest is Jackie Coombs, the multifaceted, multi-talented CEO of Amira. Prior to her current role with Amira, she held lead positions with Snowden Mining Industry Consultants and Metz Ignited Australia, as well as running her own consultancy for over a decade. I first met Jackie in 2011 in the outback of Western Australia. She joins me today from her home in Perth. Your career thus far has not been linear, per se. By that, I mean you have taken forays into disciplines that, at least to the average person, appear unrelated to geostatistics or mathematics. Can you give us a flavor of the less conventional side of your history and your experience?
I often get asked that question. I never planned on a linear career. I've always wanted to be at the edge of what I know, and I've tested that boundary continuously. So whenever there's, you know, any brutal feedback into, for example, a lawyer once said to me when I was on JORC, he said to me, "It's corporations law, you won't understand it." And I thought, well, if the law applies to me, I should understand it. And that started, I suppose, a foray, as you call it, into law. I did a master's in resources and commercial law, and it all stemmed from a question. So I didn't plan on doing the master's. I just looked for a course on corporations law, found one on mining law, then got on to corporations governance. And before you knew it, I had a grad certificate, and then I went on and did a master's. So it's just an unsatisfied curiosity that drives me.
You've authored books in addition to all the other work that you've done. And one of them is sitting behind me on my bookshelf. That's The Art and Science of Resource Estimation. Just inside the cover of this book is a quote by a pretty famous geostatistician who I believe just passed away recently or in the past couple of years. Do you know that quote offhand? I'm hoping you'll give us some background because
Absolutely.
It's kind of the preface to the book.
Absolutely. So Harry Parker was central to, I suppose, shaping the way I think. And his quote is, "An ounce of geology is worth a pound of geostatistics. If you can't handle it, tough," or something to that effect. And I loved the way Harry melded thinking into what he was doing. That was quite inspirational to me. If anybody has come across Harry, he's a really interesting man. He sits quietly or sat quietly, and often in conferences you'd look at him and it seemed as though he'd fallen asleep in the conference. And at the end of the presentation, he had the most astute question of all. He took everything into account. And that's an underlying philosophy in the book is don't be a geostatistician or be a geologist. Use what you learn to apply it to the problem. And that's the fundamental essence of that book, is really about thinking. It's a philosophy book more than anything else.
Maybe you can set the scene for us a little bit and describe the evolutionary arc of resource estimation. Why do we undertake it? And what did this process look like 100 years ago? How long have we been undertaking resource estimation?
I wasn't around 100 years ago, but
oh no.
So I can only assume. But I think what you're alluding to there is pre-geostats days. And the pre-geostats days were essentially to project a sample value across a volume. It was in the 1950s where Danny Kricher was reconciling in the Witwatersrand, and he noticed that the lower grades in the grab samples were projecting into volumes that came out as higher grade volumes, and the higher grades were coming back as lower grades. So you had this reduction in variance, so to speak. So instead of the wide sample range that you would get from your grab samples, the range in stopes was much smaller. And this became the foundational thinking into the volume variance effect, which kicked off the exploration of a theory or a modeling or a process, rather, to estimate and account for that volume variance effect, so that you could take a sample, project it into a volume, and get an estimate that was closer to reality. And that's the fundamental thinking underneath the geostats. And I think what's quite interesting about geostats is it's not born of theory or hypothesis. It actually has its basis in a pragmatic problem. Kriging, which that process became known as, was developed by Georges Matheron at Fontainebleau and named after Danny Kricher in his honor. From then, we've explored different mathematical techniques to handle different problems. But the essence of it is, how can we get an estimation method that's going to predict what we actually get out of the ground? So it's very pragmatic, really, at its heart.
Well, let's keep on with that pragmatism and define some of the key terms that are used in resource estimation. We won't be able to get through the whole lexicon of resource estimation terminology, but one of the most important concepts is that of the domain, almost the building block which we estimate into. Can you describe the domain, its importance, and why it's so critical to the estimation process?
Absolutely. So the philosophy underneath domaining is just make sure that the samples you are going to use for your estimate all come from like regions. Or like data. So you cannot use data from, say, a oxide zone to estimate in a sulfide zone, because the data comes from a different basis. So the role of domaining is to identify the limits of the, or the boundaries of the geological zones that encapsulate the samples that you will use to estimate that region.
What goes into that then? Is it lithological boundaries, alteration domains, different styles of mineralization? Can you have mixtures of those within a single domain?
This is where the role of the geologist is particularly important, is the analysis of the information that's available, the analysis of the structural information, the alteration zones, and then to imagine how the mineralization got there in the first place. So it's also understanding the geochemistry, understanding the fluid flow, understanding all of the things that geologists get a grip on and get excited about at uni. It's bringing all of that geological philosophy together to say, where's the spatial boundary that contains the information that is from the same family? And it can be an overlap. It needs to be an overlap, because geology is complex. The earth is complex. And hence the need for that complex domain knowledge to be able to identify some of the features and the connectivity between those features.
You've talked about all the different aspects that go into feeding the geological model, but the resource geologist is often not the person to define or model the geology. There's a model that's passed on for resource estimation. How important is it to have communication between the geologists modeling the geology and the geologists estimating into the model?
So there are a couple of things there. One is that every geologist needs to be conscious of what they're trying to do and why they're building a model. The model that's used by the resource geologist is to set the scene for mine planning, which will then inform the value and the cash flow, whereas the exploration geologist may be looking for what if, where is, what could be. And they may be a little more optimistic in providing some sort of geological scenario because that's what it's about. It's about testing the boundary of where that mineralization domain may be. So the communication between the exploration geologist and the resource geologist is critical for understanding not only the context, but also what sort of model they're trying to define and describe. And being conscious and cognitive of the purpose behind that model is critical. So I don't believe that either model is wrong. It's just that there's a different purpose. If you're trying to design a model to identify how much drilling you may need in terms of defining the boundary, that's a different model to the one that resource geologist needs, which says, where do I contain the information to make sure I don't smear grades into a zone where it's unlikely to exist, because that would give too much of an optimistic result for mine planning and then predict an overestimate of what the cash flows may be. And that affects business, it affects salaries, it affects financial decisions. So there's a different purpose.
So what kinds of data then can the earlier stage exploration geologists use to support domaining? I'm thinking of things like continuous scanning XRF or core scan hyperspectral work, in order to have data-supported decisions of where those boundaries are.
I'm always data hungry. So the more information you can gather around you to define that geological zone, the more likely you are to have something that's meaningful. There is a danger of swamping yourself with too much information, particularly when the information is essentially measuring the same thing. There's been a move towards machine learning, and that's valuable, because you can process a lot of information at once and very quickly, but that does not take away the philosophy, because again, you can get a reinforced view, a reinforced bias view, if you only have one style of information. So it's the variation of the information that's important there. An exploration geologist, a data set that they can make much more use of is experienced geologists. And it's the conversation around the geology that's not in a digital form, but it is incredibly valuable to take someone who's got 20, 30, 40 years experience and ask them, what do they think? They may not be right, but their thoughts and their thought processes add another layer of value to that process.
Is one way to think of this that it's very important at every stage of a project's success and moving forward to sit down as a group with people who are not perhaps involved in the project to get external input and different ideas from the drill hole planning stage, right through to the final geological model before it's presented.
And it's the perspectives they bring from their own experience. Maybe you may be looking at something, for example, only taking account of the structure and the alteration. And someone with experience who's, gone through a few knocks may say, what about the lithology? And you go, we don't have any measurement of the lithology. But, it's a silly example, but that overview and that oversight and the mentoring that comes from it is where the value comes from. And I know the time you were at St. Ives and at Goldfields, there was a policy of that questioning and challenging in a constructive way, critique as opposed to criticism, to help build the thinking that's happening and the fundamental application of the data.
Many geoscientists are probably familiar, at least tangentially, with the main estimation methods that are out there, say inverse distance, kriging. I know this is a huge question. Can you give us the layman's version of these methods and where they're most suitable, the advantages, the disadvantages?
Aisha, you know that I always take the simplest route, the parsimony. You've got to choose the method with the least amount of effort that gives you the best result. That's fundamentally I think it's really important that you don't add complexity unnecessarily, because the more complexity you add, the more opportunities there are for error. And you may think you're doing something really smart because you're using the most fantastic mathematical equation. But if it's overkill, it could introduce errors. So for me, I always try to get to the most basic approach. Now, the simplest approach is inverse distance. And inverse distance essentially says that closer samples are more related to the point of estimation than samples further away. So I'm going to weight them more, give them more emphasis. Every estimate is essentially an average where the weighting is distributed according to the distance away from the sample. The weights themselves add up to 1, which ensures that the estimate is unbiased. In other words, you get an estimate that sits in between your data. The problem with inverse distance is you don't know how much emphasis to get closer samples than samples further away. And if you're dealing with something that's fairly consistent, doesn't vary a lot, inverse distance is a pretty safe estimation method. It's used a lot, for example, in mineral sands, because there's very low variability. When data becomes more complex, and an extreme would be, you know, gold, where you're dealing with nuggets, the variation changes. You don't know whether the closest sample is the correlation between the closest sample to your point of estimation, and you have to take account of the orientation. And on top of that, the interrelationship, the spatial interrelationship of the samples. And that's where we move to kriging. Kriging is essentially an inverse distance method with one extra step, and that is an adjustment to the weighting relative to the spatial variability. The spatial variability itself is defined through the variogram. And the variogram is where we have a lot of fun as geostatisticians, because we're essentially modeling the variability, the spatial variability. And that spatial variability is not in one direction. It's in through, you know, the full multi-directional orientation, you know, a long strike, a cross strike, down dip. It's a three-dimensional football of variability that we model and then enforce through the estimation method. So when it comes to resource estimation, we've spoken about domaining, geologically informed domaining. There's an additional level that we apply during resource estimation, and that's when the orientation or the variability changes to ensure that the weighting regime we apply is relevant to the estimation point we're trying to infer.
Does it matter what stage of the process you are in? If you have 15 drill holes, and you want a kind of quick and dirty back of the envelope calculation, is it appropriate to use something like inverse distance, or is it dependent on time and what your final product and what stage of the product you're at?
And the level of confidence you want to have in it. The danger is what other people read into the numbers you provide. So it's the communication of those numbers and whether it is a back of the envelope number or whether some managing director gets hold of that, takes it to market, and you have to back it up. So it's what you do with the numbers that matters and the qualifications you put to those numbers. And this is where the JORC or the NI 43-101 classifications are very, very useful, because they're our communication tool. So if you do a back of the envelope estimate, qualify it with the levels of confidence that are available to us in measured, indicated, inferred, or say there's not enough data to classify, that the classification regimes are our friend. They're our ability to control what can be done with that information.
Maybe we can back up a step here and talk a little bit more about JORC and NI43-101. You were on the JORC board for many years. Maybe you can explain your role on the board and the equivalent bodies that exist globally.
Now, what's fascinating about the codes, all of the codes, be it the JORC or the Canadian NI43-101 or the European PERC or Pan-European Reporting Code, or the SAMREC, which is the South African equivalent. We assume they are technical codes. They are not technical codes. They are communication disclosure codes for the exchanges or securities exchanges. And they are a mechanism. I think too often we look at technology. For example, I'm approached with new data technology and go, oh, will this meet JORC compliance? And you go, It's up to the resource geologist to ascertain the reliability of the information they are predicting and presenting.
Let me ask you this then about PXRF. This is a classic example. There's been a lot of discussion about this in the past maybe 10 years as to whether more conventional laboratory-based assay techniques can be replaced with portable XRF and how that works from a compliance perspective.
If the technique gives you a reliable estimate that you can use to predict inferred, indicated, measured, different levels of confidence, it's up to the community to decide whether that's an acceptable technique or not. I refer back to my initial role coming out of uni. I worked for an oil and gas company, exploration company. And the work we did with geostats, we would have 2-3 boreholes and the rest of the data was seismic data. And we anchored our information on the seismic data. And we got brilliant estimates of depth to horizon, estimates of volume. Now, it wasn't so much the seismic data that was the quality. The quality was in the geophysicists who were able to convert that information to something we could anchor and rely on. The data itself that we used had gone through multiple layers of processing, and we only had a few boreholes. In petroleum, the boreholes are so expensive. It's interesting to me that we are still so afraid in mining industry of these various techniques that just add another layer of information. They may not be the same quality, but they add a layer of information.
When you say this is a decision from the community, who is this community and how do you come to that decision then? So if, for example, a resource based on 90% PXRF data and 10% conventional laboratory data were to be reported, and I actually don't know, I'm sure this might have happened already, is that something that's acceptable and who deems that acceptable?
What you do is report to the investor.
Right.
So if you can back it up and you can show that confidently there's a good correlation, I don't see why not. The secret is to demonstrate. And reconciliation is that space where you can demonstrate. So if you could retrospectively demonstrate that it correlates well, you may need adjustments to the data. I don't understand what the fear is because an assay is not perfect. There are so many errors with assay. I mean, it's a teaspoon. How on earth do we we take a teaspoon and we project that value onto, you know, a meter of resource on the assumption that we've, you know, homogenized it properly, that we've filtered it, subset it properly. Now, we'd be daft to believe in the perfection of that value. I suppose I throw it out there. What if XRF gives you a better estimate than assays? What if there's less variability in an XRF? What if there's a technique around XRFs that if you take enough samples, that gives you the same? And maybe it's that XRF and you've got to adjust it slightly, like playing golf. You know, you might be hitting the ball continuously, systematically to the left of the hole. All you have to do is move the golfer slightly so that they're on target.
The last point I want to touch on is a little bit philosophical in nature, which again, I think is right up your alley. Can anyone learn to be a resource geologist? And What skills can they recognize in themselves that might lend them to being a good resource geologist?
So that was one of the fundamental questions that set me off on my PhD research. I wanted to know, what is competency in the terms Jorkin and NI 43-101? What is that competency and what does it take to develop that competency? And I believe that most people who enter the field are on a journey. People take different lengths of time to get to that competency. It's not something you can rush. So coming back to the opening question you asked about my linear journey, I don't think anyone should have a linear journey. We should nurture talent. We should nurture our own talent. We should contribute to the talent of the people around us. We can't be average. No one should be average, but everyone should contribute.
Thank you so much for joining us on the SEG podcast and bringing your excitement and passion for geostatistics to the broader exploration audience. Next up, we're going to talk to another guru in the resource estimation space, looking at the practical side. What are some of the common pitfalls that plague the process, and what can the project geologist do to avoid these mistakes?
My name is Renee Sturck, and I'm the principal resource consultant for RSC Consulting. I'm based in Dunedin, do a lot of work overseas, particularly in Australia and Africa and Asia, and glad to be here.
The first time I ever had an interaction with you, I think it was one of these one-way interactions where I knew who you were and you didn't know who I was, but it was back in 2017 at a conference in Hobart. I remember you delivering a really great presentation on the dire state of public reporting, and it ruffled some feathers. And this is what you've kind of become known for. Can you give us some background on how you developed this passion for resource modeling, QAQC, public reporting, and geoscience as a whole?
Just starting at the back, maybe, I mean, just talking about public reporting, you know, with a structural geology degree, public reporting isn't particularly something you think you get into, but the whole reason I took an interest is that was the only place that I could go to look at what others are doing. I found it always very difficult to compare myself professionally, you know, from an output perspective with the standard. Well, there's the standard, and where does it come from, and who talks about the standard, and what's the platform? So the whole reason I started to take an interest is literally when I wrote my first JORC report, because, you know, I was able to read what others were doing technically, and based on that, make up my own opinions, whether that was good work or whether I was doing something different. And that interest sort of grew into a bit of a conception of, it's interesting that so many people are doing so many different things. And then I got further into it and started comparing, you know, outputs, I guess, in terms of different platforms.
It's really interesting because some of the talks that I've heard you give recently have really encouraged people not to only follow the standard, but to question why the standard is there.
Well, with the why, I mean, that whole question is it's everywhere, and particularly with the codes. Why is it the way it is? Why are we doing this thing? Why is table one in a JORC report? I mean, most people that I talk to think it is some JORC police thing that must be there, otherwise bad things happen to you. And the whole idea behind it is lost a little bit. And so the why is fundamentally the question, why are we doing these things?
Just for maybe some of our more early career listeners, maybe you can give us a little bit of perspective as to why the discovery-focused geologist, the geologist who doesn't want to work in the mine, doesn't want to do the underground sampling, you know, doesn't want to do the pattern drill out. Why should they care about resource estimation?
Sure. Well, it's always important to know what you're looking for. So as an exploration geologist, if you haven't been in a mine or haven't worked in a mine or haven't been across that process, then it's very hard to conceptualize in your head what a discovery looks like and what a drill hole needs to lead to a discovery. And you can touch on really important aspects like sample support and drill spacing and all those sorts of things that are quite important from a resource development stage perspective. So, you know, it's important to have that link and to have people fully across that mining value chain to understand what lies ahead of them.
I know for myself, one of the best things I ever did was work in the more brownfields exploration environment and being able to see deposits from an air core sample right through to the face underground.
It depends what your pathway is and what your personal challenge is. I mean, I actually entered the industry as a mapper. I wanted to map. That's all I ever wanted to do. Didn't care what they were doing with it afterwards. This whole mineral exploration world was completely unknown to me, and I just wanted to map. If you're in that space and your personal drive is to be that early greenfield stage specialist, you're determined to remain in that space. You don't really need to know about all these flow-on things, but it's certainly very helpful if you want to be across the entire mining value chain and understand what the end product is, because you are going to deliver something that somebody needs to use downstream. That's as simple as it is. And if you don't know what that downstream is, then it's very hard to tune your product to that.
Okay, well, let's talk about the different stages that are involved and lead up to a resource estimation, maybe starting with the first drill hole and that initial discovery, even though it's probably not on the first drill hole, but you know, within the first few drill holes and then right out to the final geological model and resource model.
It all just depends on the type of deposits that you're trying to find as well. Are you undercover? Is it outcropping at surface? Have you already got some good grade data from some trenches? Can you do some low cost exploration things first before you start drilling expensive holes? And so on. So it's certainly not a flow chart, but a few things that might apply and that I do see frequently is the data that you collect is going to be helpful for us downstream as well. So there can be more diligence with the early stage data collected. We quite often as consultants here with RSC, we get data sets on our desk and you know the data's been collected, but it's just not been handled with care. And that's perhaps something that explorers might not focus on as much, because we try to extract as much information from the data that lies in front of us. People do what they can with the resources and the time that they have. So it will be forever a tug of war. But generally speaking, yes, if explorers would have a little bit more knowledge of what we do with the data, I think we can do a lot better in this space.
So what do you do with the data, and what kinds of data sets are you thinking about? You know, qualitative versus quantitative data sets. Is this logging, alteration, or are you talking about assays?
I usually break it up into a few buckets that are important when you end up building models. The first thing to me is location. Right? The location of your data must be accurate. If you don't know where the data sits, I'm forever just making assumptions and guessing. And that's a very frustrating place to be. And that starts with the collar locations. If we're just talking drilling data, obviously here, when we start talking about 3D models and so on, then not having good collar locations is really frustrating. And it all sounds so easy because at the end of the day, a collar gets drilled and somebody with a GPS will stand there and click a button. But the amount of collar swaps and, you know, different holes drilled from the same platform where the data have been swapped over to all the way through to just inaccuracies because you're under canopy and the GPS doesn't work, or to the fact that people don't use DGPS to pick up their holes and they think GPS plus or minus 10 in poor coverage is good enough. All of these things start building into that. And then you have the downhole survey. And I recently done quite a bit of work in downhole surveying of dip and azimuth. And, you know, I wonder how many people have heard of the term dogleg severity. It's such an important tool because we just trust the drillers to click the tool that goes down the hole and then we get a number and it goes in the database. And there is some sort of QC process that the driller is aware of through the manual in front of him. But ultimately, all those data are going to be sitting in the database. And if you see that on your screen, you get all these weird kinks and funny things, and then it always comes months after the hole's been drilled, and it becomes really difficult to go back to it. And if you have a 500-meter hole and you got a 1-degree error that promulgates down the hole, at the bottom of your hole, you could be 50 meters out, right? So if I start joining dots on my screen here with data that are 50 meters out, it's going to turn into a soup.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about quantitative data sets. And I certainly understand that this may be different depending on what commodity you're working with or the deposit type. But what are your views on this kind of high density, high resolution, continuous scanning or core scanning data that you can get? Do you see value in it, particularly for supporting geological modeling and domaining?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a big fan, and I'm probably not going to be very popular with the very conventional geology space here. I consider myself a structural geologist and love my rocks, but the ability for us to get consistent geological data out of our core or chips is just, to the best of our efforts, just really difficult. I can write books on the quality of the Lith 1 conundrum, and it is, yeah, it's difficult because there are six geologists and they all do their darndest, but if you ask six geologists to log the same hole, you will get different logs. There's just no way around that. However hard you try, however good the geologists are, you'll get six different logs. So that means there will be variance sitting in your database. And when I ultimately have to build that 3D geological model, 9 out of 10 times I throw the whole geology table out the window and I go straight to my proxy data, as I call it, you know, my portable XRF, geochem, multi-element data, because that will give me my Lith 1 and various other tools that you can apply there to try and recreate that Lith 1 table. All those things are important because we are going to look at geology and not just at numbers, and we need to know where the important parts of the geology, you know, glued together. So for me, the core scanner is an absolute solution, but we are so afraid as an industry to modernize there and you know, have the geologist supposedly take a back seat to the machine. And that's not how at all how I see it. I mean, the geologist needs to be involved, but a core scanning device that indeed takes millimeter size data from core is extremely accurate. And I've seen this work, and you said, you know, depending on the deposit, I'd go one step further. I would say that almost every deposit you will get value out of this.
I mean, is this the future of resource estimation then? And not just resource estimation, but perhaps the whole mining value chain, starting from the core shack workflow where you're using this kind of data to inform logging, right through to the resource estimation and the processing stage and waste rock evaluation.
I know a couple of groups that have completely automated that entire process from logging through to resource modeling, and I am blown away by it. But so far, in trying to get our clients to adopt it, there is some resistance because it's a budget expense. It isn't anticipated. It's unknown. Will it work? You have to run tests. And by the time that discussion goes the rounds between the various, you know, people that have input there, half the drill program is finished and it might be taken on for the next run. So it's still not as widely implemented as it should, but yes, I think that's really where the next 5 or 10 years is going to take us.
What about the companies that are not doing it right? And we're certainly not here to name and shame, but can you give some examples of failures in this process along these early stages of the workflow that leads up to a resource estimation and why these failures happened?
I do take an interest in when it goes wrong, because if we can't learn when it goes wrong, there's no saving us as an industry, I guess. Lack of processes is where I think it goes wrong. It's not for the lack of skills necessarily. There are good people on board, and this applies across the mining value chain and also the type of work. But I'm thinking that these things must be able to be prevented by systems and processes. And I take an interest in that space because I do a lot in the QA and QC space, as you know, and people can have systems lying on a shelf collecting dust, and the actual implementations of those systems and the actual quality control and the ability to check and balance as you're doing things, that's where things become tricky. A reason why I put a 2019 paper out on resource domaining, because I think that's a fundamental area of weakness that the industry can do better at, and we need some standards. The exploration geologist's work will flow into the domaining that we use to constrain our estimates. If we don't constrain our estimates, then we're going to estimate really badly. You can throw all the fancy estimation tools at it, but if your domains aren't correct, correct, between inverted commas, then it's going to be really quite difficult. The damage that you can do depends on the style of ore body, but you see most of these things where they fail are the sort of coarse gold ore bodies. You don't know necessarily where it's gone wrong. You just know that something has gone wrong in that space of geology, complexity of mineralization, and that flow over from exploration to resource to reserve hasn't really quite gone very well. There is a deposit in 2015. There were quoted deviations in the geology and structures seen from the drilling. So there was a downgrade there. There is a deposit in 2016, also quote new interpretations regarding the mineralization to be a major reason why things weren't the way they thought they would be. These deposits are very difficult to capture with resource estimation.
Is this happening when one company has undertaken multiple estimations at different stages, or is this happening when one company takes over and it's a resource estimation happening after that transition?
Yeah, both possible, but it can swing both ways. I've just been involved with a transition where the resource was quadrupled after a resource report came out, but quite often when the actual in-house resource geologists that are responsible for reconciliation and production come online, under-promise and over-deliver is their way of approaching things sometimes. Different companies will have different conversion strategies as well when it comes from resources to reserves. A lot of juniors, they probably would like to have it set as high as possible when ultimately they are taken over, because that's the bargaining power that they deal with. I think a lot of these particular failures were over a number of years on the same project with the same owner. And that's probably where a lot of this sneaks in, right? It's a process where the quality control isn't really quite working. But if a new owner would come along with their new professionals and new consultants and, you know, new resource geologists, that's when you could actually find some of these things, because somebody could look at it and say, well, hold on, that's a bit strange. You know, the joke goes, a resource geologist will say 2 + 2 is between 3 and 5. That's what we do, where the engineers will say 4.0 and the geophysicist will say, what do you want it to be? So it's the old joke, and it is really quite difficult to get that right. So variance is obviously a resource killer, and I still see a lot of coarse gold deposits from Northern America that have been assayed with 30 gram fire assays on half NQ core, supporting an indicated resource at, you know, 40 meter spacing. That sort of is difficult when it comes to reconciliation and seeing how these things come out of the ground. And that might be one of the reasons why some of these projects are getting downgraded, because that sort of concept. And I think for exploration geologists to get back on point, to understand variance and to know what goes on in your lab and why it is good to submit the largest sample you can, or collect the largest sample you can, is really important. So I'm a big fan. Once you've done your exploration and we know the structure, or if we have the knowledge that we need and you're not going to come back to the core that you drill, I would advocate to sample whole core and crush and leach that whole core to get the best handle on your sample variance.
I mean, it also links back to collecting these really strong quantitative data sets, whether that's excellent high-resolution photography or, you know, these large high-resolution geochemical data sets. So you do have something to go back to and a record to go back to.
That's absolutely right. It depends. If you're in a really tricky deposit and you don't actually know what you're dealing with, and there might be all sorts of subtleties that you don't understand, from alteration or logging or structure or overprinting structures in the core or whatever it may be, then you would be a little bit more cautious. The added value of submitting a whole core sample rather than half core, you reduce your variance by a factor 2. Very important for explorers to sort of get their head in the variance space and working out a good balance between data collection and costs and so on.
Just to circle back a little bit to public reporting, do some of these failures or where it's gone really wrong relate to or feed into a need for greater prescriptive standardization? I've recently refreshed myself with some of the standards that we use in Canada for reporting. So the National Instrument 43101 and the Canadian Institute of Mining and Metallurgy Best Practice Guidelines. And these are by no means prescriptive documents, and they're not meant to be. So the determination of what is correct or appropriate is really left up to the geologist or the company. Are you content with the current level of standardization, whether it's the JORC or NI 43101 reporting guidelines?
I would say not at all. I'm frustrated by self-regulation. I don't get that. There's this wonderful thing called the Dunning-Kruger effect, and we all suffer greatly from it. And on a daily basis, I'm trying to be not that guy.
Just a quick aside here for those of you who aren't familiar. The Dunning-Kruger effect is a person's inability to recognize their own lack of ability. So without the self-awareness of metacognition, people can't objectively really evaluate their own level of competence. Back to Renee.
If you start allowing people to self-regulate their competence, then it gets really tricky, especially because there is no real trajectory. You know, there is no university degree in resource estimation, and you are a resource geologist because, you know, you like sitting behind a computer and spinning models around, and maybe have a geostats degree, and that's good. But the difficult part there is that, you know, most geologists are not geostatisticians, and most geostatisticians are not geologists, and both ingredients are so vital to the resource that it's just really difficult to find extremely competent people that also have the experience to know what works and doesn't work, which you can't read from a book and you can't get from a flowchart. There is a very active debate going on at the moment on this side of the ditch that certification is something that will come towards us here. I mean, you guys have RPGO up there, which is actually quite a good process. I'm quite impressed by, you know, the fact that people have to sit an exam before they can get their certification.
You do sit an exam, and it's an ethics and law exam, but it is not technical. Mm-hmm. And I do find that a missing component. When you were talking about being a competent person, where is that regulation on the technical competence? So if you were to be designing your dream global regulatory system, mm-hmm. would it include technical competence and examination on that as well?
Look, this is indeed...
How would you do that?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, there's so much debate on this for years now, and the difficulty is that all of these ore bodies are different. They require different skills and different sets of experiences. So people are very reticent to design a system that says you must have these 10 things to that degree before you can sign off on it. The other problem would be if we create that, where are our qualified persons and competent persons when you talk JORC going to come from? Because they won't be, because you call 90% out of that group straight away. So who's going to sign off on all these resources? So it's a very nasty problem to solve. And on a weekly basis, we see issues that come right from that. And just to clear up that point as well, when it comes to the reporting codes, you can write in an NI 43101 report what you want technically, but the regulators are not checking that, right? They're only checking legally whether you've written the right disclaimers around your resources, does it include reserves and all the rest of it. You know, they are looking for those things, but nobody is checking whether you have done your work, quote unquote, correctly. And that's difficult because you don't just do that. You don't just have a tick box where it says, okay, have they applied this top cut properly? Codes are not codes that regulate how you do your work. They are reporting codes. That is probably the most fundamental misconception in the industry. You just need to say what you've done, right? And therein lies the danger and perhaps the controversy. And this is another paper that I put out on Table 1 in JORC particularly. You can write in there what you like. You can write about the birds and the bees and wonderful stories about wizards and elves and dwarves. And nobody could really challenge you because you have filled out Table 1. And there is no pathway available to anybody to say, well, that person isn't competent because he has said this about the duplicates or the core or the quality of this or that. Yeah, just a few thoughts on that whole competency issue, which will probably rave on for years to come.
Renee, it's been an absolute pleasure discussing the ins and outs of competency with you and other aspects of resource estimation. Thanks so much for taking the time today.
Thank you for joining us on the Discovery to Recovery podcast. I'm Aisha Ahmed, one of the hosts of this podcast series. You can access past episodes on segweb.org/podcasts. Be sure to follow the SEG and Goldspot Discoveries on Twitter, LinkedIn, and other social media channels to get notified when the next episode comes out. This podcast episode was written and produced by myself, Aisha Ahmed of Tech Resources, with editing support from Ann Thompson, Hallie Keevil, and Sam Weatherly. Our theme music is Confluence by East Winds from their album Confluence. You can check them out at eastwinds.bandcamp.com. Thanks for listening to this week's episode, and we'll catch you again next week.
Hey, student chapters, don't forget, the deadline for the chapter podcast challenge is coming up on the 29th of March. Not long now. We're looking forward to hearing all of your audio submissions and sharing them with the community of economic geologists globally. You've got time, so let's get it done.